On the show today, flipping the script for yourself and way more broadly.
Tonight, the planet reaches an alarming milestone.
No human has ever seen it hotter.
This message is everywhere. Anytime we watch, listen, or scroll.
Out of control wildfires.
Devastating floods.
From a tropical storm to a Category 5 hurricane in the space.
It's scary. People's lives are being ruined. But also, it's exhausting to constantly hear that climate change is getting worse.
Not just climate, but also air pollution, food production, deforestation, biodiversity loss. Like, we have a long list of environmental problems that we're facing.
This is data scientist Hannah Ritchie.
I'm a senior researcher at the University of Oxford, and I'm deputy editor of Our World in Data, which tries to use data and research to understand the world's largest problems. It's very hard to see any kind of signs of progress. It just looks like things are getting worse and worse and worse.
And while it's true the world is getting warmer, there are trends going the wrong direction. Hannah says there is a more productive way to look at it.
Yeah, I think there's some downside to only surrounding yourself and just headline after headline after headline of negative impacts. Because when you actually step back to look at the data and look at historical trends, we can see that progress is possible and it has happened. And I think we need to see that to be able to understand that we can make things better in the future.
Hannah Ritchie continues from the TED stage.
A large international survey asked 10,000 young people about their attitudes to climate change. More than half said they think humanity is doomed, 3/4 find the future frightening, and more than 1 in 3 are hesitant to have children of their own. Young people today truly feel like they could be the last generation. Now I get this feeling. I've been there. I used to feel like humanity was doomed. Despite having multiple environmental degrees, I felt completely helpless to do anything about it. But I'm a data scientist, and after years poring over the data on how far humanity's come and how quickly things are now moving, my perspective on this has changed. I think we've got this framing upside down. Far from being the last generation, I think we'd be the first generation to be sustainable.
We could be the first generation that is sustainable. Can we? That kind of blew me away in some ways, but because I was like, no, you're going to be the first generation that's not even here. That's the message that we're getting.
Right. Yeah, I think it's quite a controversial statement. Because most of the messaging is around, there's actually activist groups called Last Generation. And I wanted to turn that on its head and say, no, like, I think we can stop this. We can challenge this. And we could be the first generation to achieve sustainability.
Talk me through how you came to that conclusion, that this is possible. And what you even mean by sustainable.
So I have quite a specific definition of sustainability. Providing a good life for everyone today while protecting the environment for future generations.
How do we do that? In a minute, why Hannah Ritchie thinks a good life and protecting the environment is possible, and how the data backs her up. On the show today, Flipping the Script. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and we'll be right back. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, Flipping the Script. We were just talking to data scientist Hannah Ritchie. She's the author of Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet.
I think we have the opportunity to provide 8 billion people with a good life while reducing our environmental impact.
It's a message that can feel unbelievable. Well, Hannah wants to change our minds, starting with our assumption that our grandparents had more sustainable lives than we do.
Yeah, exactly. I think my grandparents would look at my lifestyle and think, oh, you're using these phones and this computer, and it looks like a really energy-intensive lifestyle, so therefore I should have much higher carbon emissions. But when you look at carbon emissions in the UK over time, what you see is that when my grandparents were my age, the average CO2 emissions per person were around 12 tonnes per year.
Wow.
That didn't change much between them and my parents. They were still very, very high at around 12 tonnes per person. Now, what we've seen after across the last few decades is that emissions in the UK have plummeted. So now the emissions per person in the UK are around 5 to 6 tonnes, which means that my carbon footprint today is about half that of my grandparents when they were my age. More recent data tells us a slightly different story, a more hopeful story that we can turn things around. My carbon footprint today is less than half that of my grandparents when they were my age. And that's despite the fact I live a much more extravagant lifestyle, or as they'd put it, you youngsters just don't know how good you've got it these days. Now, you might think the UK's cheating here. It used to be this industrial powerhouse. Now it just gets China, India, Bangladesh to produce its stuff for it. Maybe it's just offshored all of these emissions. Now, there's a bit of truth to this. When we adjust for trade, emissions in the UK are higher. But we still see this dramatic decline over the last few decades. Offshoring is a bit of the story, but it's not the entire story. At the same time, the UK has increased its GDP. GDP has gone up while emissions have come down. And it's not the only country to achieve this. A long list of countries have increased GDP while reducing their emissions. The notion that economic growth has to be incompatible with reducing our environmental impact is simply wrong. Now, rich countries are reducing their emissions, but low and middle-income countries are increasing theirs. What does this mean at a global level? Well, total CO2 emissions are now beginning to flatline, but actually emissions per person already peaked a decade ago. That means the emissions of the average person in the world today have peaked and are now falling, and we will see a peak in total CO2 emissions soon.
So CO2 emissions in many countries are actually going down. What are these countries doing that is driving that?
Yeah, the big driver of that decline has been a reduction in coal. In the past, most of the UK's energy production was coming from coal, and we're now nearly in the position where coal is completely out of the electricity mix and we're not burning anymore. In many countries in the world, coal is dying. Taking its place are renewables, where costs are plummeting. Go back a decade and solar and wind were among the most expensive energy technologies we had. But just 10 years on and that script has flipped. In many countries in the world, solar and wind are now the cheapest. Now, if we're going to have renewables, we're going to need energy storage. But there's good news there too. The price of batteries has fallen by 98% since 1990. If you take the battery you'd find in a Tesla today, go back to 1990, it would have cost $1 million. It now costs just $12,000. That's completely transformed the world of energy storage and completely transformed the world of transport. Global sales of petrol and diesel cars have already peaked. They peaked in 2017 and they are now falling. Taking their place are electric cars, where in the space of just a few years, sales are going through the roof. The cost of these technologies has plummeted. You just get this kind of feedback loop where the more you deploy, the cheaper they get. And I think that's actually why I'm much more optimistic on climate than I was a decade ago.
Okay, so the data on emissions and renewable energy is really encouraging. But you also see a more hopeful story in other areas that maybe we haven't considered, like air pollution, which feels like it's just getting worse, but actually isn't.
Yeah, I think air pollution has a few key stories in it. So two big ones there are the ozone layer. The ozone problem was kind of before my time, but countries worked together. We brought in policies to stop emissions of the gases that were destroying the ozone layer, and we've reduced emissions by more than 99%. So that's effectively solved. The other big one there is acid rain. Europe and North America put in really strong policies to reduce sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain. And again, these emissions have fallen by more than 90%. I think there's another dimension to this, which is localized air pollution. We often assume that our cities are the most polluted they've ever been, but rich countries actually have dramatically reduced local air pollution.
What about on a global scale? You're mentioning rich countries where it's better, but what about poorer countries in terms of their contributions to the overall air pollution and the lives of their citizens more locally?
I think there is a mix across what we call middle-income countries. China's levels of air pollution, local air pollution, have plummeted actually very, very quickly. So emissions of some pollutants in China have fallen by 2/3 in just 7 years. So it has actually taken on very, very strict pollution controls, and they have been very effective. I mean, levels of pollution in countries like India or Pakistan or Bangladesh, many industrializing countries are still very, very high. They're way, way above healthy guidelines. But we know that middle and low-income countries will go through the same pathway that rich countries have. So our big question is, can we implement these solutions much, much faster such that we reduce deaths greatly along that pathway?
What I love about this is that by getting into specifics and looking at the bright spots, we see what we can do instead of just feeling like, oh, everything is lumped together into one big climate disaster.
Right.
And another example is you have researched what's happening to our forests.
Sure.
And that is surprising too.
From energy and transport to the food we eat, you might imagine that global deforestation is at its highest level ever. But actually, global deforestation peaked decades ago and is now falling. But actually, it's better than that, because many countries are now regrowing their old forests, such as the net decline is even more impressive. Now, why is this happening? A big driver has been an increase in crop yields. Over the last century, across many countries and many different crop types, crop yields have skyrocketed. Here we see it for the US for corn, where yields have grown sixfold, from 2 tons to 12 tons. Now, what this means is that we can grow a lot more food from a lot less land. My main point here is that in the past, human progress had to come at the cost of the environment. If we wanted energy, we had to burn wood, or we had to burn fossil fuels. If we wanted to grow more food, we had to expand farmlands, often at the cost of forests. But technology and innovation means we're very quickly decoupling these impacts, such as this conflict is no longer true.
It sounds in some way that you feel like we're humans. We figure out solutions. We make changes. We will have to operate on this earth in a different way. It will not be the same, but it also will still be here, at least when it comes to environmental action.
Yeah, I think too often, and I do it myself, it's very easy to just take where we are or where we've been going and just extrapolate that line out and just assume this is just going to continue on exactly the same path, and by the middle of the century, we're going to be gone. But yeah, I don't think that's the case. Like, I really believe in human ingenuity. We are making progress. Yes, these problems are big, they're urgent, but we have many of the solutions and we just really need to get going on deploying them. And then I think what we also need is to have like a Northern Star of this is where we want to go and this is what our future could look like.
Yeah, what is that North Star for you?
Yeah, I think for me, this kind of utopia is a world where 8, 9, 10 billion people have a nutritious diet and we use just a fraction of the land that we do today to produce farming, and we reforest and we bring wild habitats back. We live in a world where we have very cheap, abundant, clean energy. Everyone lives in a good home that's got heating or cooling that they need. They're not spending half of their income on really high energy costs. We have really efficient, productive cities where we have really connected networks. So I think it's marrying these two thoughts together where you can provide a good life for everyone and we can live that life with a very, very low environmental impact.
That's Hannah Ritchie. She's deputy editor at Our World in Data and a senior researcher at Oxford University. Her book is called Not the End of the World: How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet. You can see her full talk at TED.com.